Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Say, is your vehicle ready for winter driving? I tell you what, I've got a guest to help you out with that. Jim Ward in the studio with me today. Once again, he's the service director at Smart Motors. Lots of experience, over 10 years of master certification. I think he's 30 years in the business. And if you've heard him talk before on the show, you know there's not much he can't answer when it comes to cars. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. We'll talk about getting ready for winter driving. We'll answer your vehicle questions. And you can call in at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Jim Ward, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here this morning.
You know what? I'm going to start out with an email just because it relates right to what we were talking about. Perfect. To begin the show. Veronica emailed to say she just bought four new tires and they're inflated to about 35 PSI. The car specs say they should be 30. Should she deflate them?
Well, it depends on where she is. I'm guessing she's probably in Wisconsin, and in that case, the answer is probably not. And the reason for that is that manufacturers have a set pressure, and it can be a little confusing because the tire may have a number, tire will have a number on it. That's the maximum pressure. The manufacturer doesn't know what that tire is going on. So the real spec you want to read is the placard on the driver's door jamb, either on the end of the driver's door or the door jamb, that will say what the pressure should be. However, that's under ideal driving conditions, and that would mean ideal temperatures. Manufacturers have a chart that we use in a shop. You're supposed to anticipate what the temperature is going to be for the next 3 to 6 months that the customer is driving, and in fact, in colder anticipated temperatures, there is an inflation of about 3 to 5 pounds, depending on the size of the tire and what the spec is, that you do increase them. So, if the tire pressure is too high under different conditions, you'll wear the very center part of the tire more, but that is likely the correct spec for Wisconsin for the season that we're going into.
Yep. And here's another email that relates to this as well. Julie emailed to say the car she's giving to her son should have the tires replaced for driving in snow, but her son lives in Nashville, Tennessee. Can she hold off on replacing?
You know, I know Nashville gets some winter weather. That's probably not the predominant weather that he's going to be driving in. The wear, though, there's a couple things to think about for tires. If the tires are getting down to 4 or 5 thirty-seconds of an inch, that's still usable tread. The legal wear limit in most states is 2 thirty-seconds of an inch. But stopping distances, even on wet roads, without any winter conditions, just in the summertime driving on wet roads, the stopping distances increase greatly when you have reduced tread like that. When you're in that range of 4 or 5 thirty-seconds of an inch, you may take 150 to 200 feet longer to stop at 60 miles an hour. They've done tests on this. And so that's a significant difference. So if those tires are down in that range, and Nashville certainly may not get a lot of snow, but they get a winter season with rain and that kind of thing, that is an important consideration. So if the tires are that thin and we're going into that season, it is something I'd consider doing.
So just to kind of go along with what she was emailing about, what type of tire is best suited to drive in Wisconsin? Are snow tires a necessity, or are they worth it?
Well, some of the primary considerations for whether you should or shouldn't go with snow tires are where you live and the conditions that you have to drive under. If you live in the city, then, you know, reasonably, the speed limits are a little bit lower. Roads tend to be plowed earlier in the day. If you live out in a rural area, and if you have a lot of hills on your commute and curves, those are considerations where that traction is going to be pretty important. The roads don't get plowed as early out in rural areas. If you have to drive on hills and in open areas where snow can drift, that can be pretty important. So those are really the primary things for considering having dedicated snow tires. Dedicated snow tires, too, are a bit different. Even tires that are called mud and snow don't really have a set of specific
configuration,
or standards that they have to standards that they have to meet. So snow tires have a particular type of rubber that is designed and engineered to behave a little bit differently under 45 degrees. So 45 degrees is also kind of a key temperature you want to think about putting them on, taking them off. In the spring, when the temperatures are consistently above that, those tires are going to wear faster than they should. But snow tires, the type of tread they have, the type of slits between the tread and everything are designed specifically for snow. snow. Something called a mud and snow is really kind of like a jack of all trades, master of none. It's not really preferable to a snow tire. So if you are in those driving conditions in the country, hills, roads are plowed later, you want to consider a real dedicated snow tire.
Do you, when you replace tires, do you go with four, or can you get away with two, or what's...
Tire manufacturers and automotive manufacturers recommend that you go with four of the same kind of tires. The car will handle...
perform better.
Right. Imagine having a snowshoe on one foot or cleats on one foot and not on the other. It just, that doesn't work as well. You might get by. But once you start getting into more extreme situations, emergency situations, and those are more likely in that season, it's pretty critical to have the same tread.
And what do you expect to pay for a good set of tires?
It varies huge. You can get tires for under $400 for some vehicles. Other vehicles that have run flat tires and specialized tires may be well over $1,000. So the range is pretty large. When you're shopping for tires, you want to shop around and take a look at the different deals. The tire specialty stores versus dealers used to be quite a difference. Dealers generally, new car dealers, especially buy their tires from a single source, whether you're Dodge or Chevy
whoever.
Or a Toyota dealer, you're buying from an organization called Dealer Tire. Gives you the buying power and a little bit more advantage than we used to have. If you can, I would recommend buying them from where you normally service your car and try to keep your services in one place and keep that relationship going if the price is reasonably close.
All right, there we go. Jim Ward, our guest today, service director at Smart Motors. We're talking about sort of getting the car ready for winter, but taking vehicle maintenance questions in general as well. So I hope you'll join in. Open lines get you on pretty quickly. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions or comments, or like Julie and Veronica did, you can email us. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Another thing I wanted to talk about was a functioning heater. How do you maintain the heating system?
Well, your heating system and the engine's cooling system have a lot in common, because the heat that you get in your car primarily comes from the antifreeze that cools the engine. It gets hot, it flows through a little device in the dash, it's like another little radiator, and then your blower fan blows the air through that. So maintaining the engine's cooling system, first of all, making sure that the antifreeze is changed when it's supposed to be changed. Manufacturers have great variance on when that should be done. Some manufacturers will say every 2 years or 30,000 miles, but more and more manufacturers are using super long life antifreeze, and those will last much longer. Some of them are over 100,000 miles.
Oh my goodness! I didn't know that.
But maintaining that system, one of the things on the inside of the car that is a little bit more specific to the heating and cooling system has to do with the blower fan itself. And most cars now have cabin filters, pollen filters they call them, and those they're the first thing inside the car where the air from outside comes in. So any kind of, if you park under trees that have a lot of small debris falling, that stuff can get in there and kind of plug that filter up. It's a favorite home for rodents. A mouse can get into that area. This cabin filter will kind of stop them, but they love to chew holes through that. So keeping that filter clean and so that you get good airflow through it is a key to getting good defrosting and just good airflow and good heat and air conditioning wherever the season.
And batteries, I'm thinking back now, it's been a long time since I had a battery go on me. They usually go when you're least expecting it, though.
Yep, when it's least convenient is what's likely. Battery life, well, throughout the country, battery life is kind of related to temperature, and it's kind of not intuitive, but it batteries have the shortest life in the hottest part of the country. So if you take the bottom fifth of the country, and you can kind of draw a line across, except that it kind of spikes up in Texas because there's a heat spike in Texas that goes way up. Those areas tend to have about 2 to 3 years of battery life. And you would think that the Wisconsin winters and the cold weather would be harder on them, but we actually do about as well as anyone across the range of temperatures in our country. And in our part of the country, the average is more like 5 years. That being said, battery technology is one of the greatest advancements in changes in cars. And we see original batteries last 11 years plus anymore. And the other change is that the battery testers, they used to just be resistor packs, and it was pass fail. Now they have ability to kind of intuit a little bit what the health and the life of that battery may be, and so the battery may still be starting the car fine and really not noticing. And what we used to go by, you know, if it started sounding kind of sluggish on that cold start, you kind of my battery might be the problem. But now they have the ability to anticipate that with these testers long before you may actually have a failure on it. So, you know, typically the idea is to take the car in twice a year. In that visit, they most shops are going to do a multi-point inspection. Part of that is testing the battery, and in most cases, you're going to be told, you know, this battery is getting compromised, and that's the time to start thinking about replacing it.
Yeah, and this, frankly, it is no fun to be in the middle of somewhere away from home, and your battery is dead on you.
Yep. It's either the day you're trying to get to a wedding all dressed up, and it's hot out, or it's wintertime, and you're late. Yeah, it's not convenient.
All right. Well, lots of callers online to visit with you, Jim, so we'll take some phone calls next. Aaron in Appleton, we'll give you a chance. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a newer Dodge Ram Laramie Limited. It's got that 8-speed, so it's supposed to be really good on gas mileage, et cetera. And I travel a lot for work, so I'm driving really long distances. And occasionally, after I'm driving for 4 or 5 hours, consistently, the temperature is always consistent on the transmission, but I'll get into, you know, city driving like in Minneapolis, St. Paul, or Chicago, and I'll get onto these, you know, what they call clover leaves, and step on the gas, and the thing acts like I'm driving my old Dodge truck with, you know, I put my clutch in, and it just misses that gear. I brought it in to the dealership because it's a newer vehicle, and they said that they referenced, I believe, a STARS system, and that there's been reports of that issue before. But I guess for me, you know, they're like, well, there's nothing really to fix. I can't check the transmission fluid on this style of automatic transmission. So my question, I guess, is should I be worried? Is there a possibility that, you know, it's a lemon transmission, et cetera? So that's kind of my question.
Sure, yeah. It's not likely that it's a lemon transmission. I mean, these modern transmissions with 8 speeds don't really have 8 gears. They use ratios between the gears they do have to achieve that, and they do some pretty amazing things. I mean, at low speeds in city driving on a fairly flat road, you know, if you had a computer hooked up that you could see what gear it was in, they can do some pretty amazing things. They may be in, you know, 5th, 6th gear at, you know, 25 to 30 miles an hour, 30 to 40, and give you really good gas mileage because of that. But some of the things that tend to happen with those electronically controlled, computer-controlled transmissions is that there's some learning, that it's adaptive to how you drive a little bit, and it also, there are just times that those transmissions feel like they're indecisive, like they can't decide just where they want to be. And that's somewhat characteristic of them, although various manufacturers will come out with software reflashes that can be done. If enough customers complain, you know, they decide that it's just not smooth enough, they'll do a software change, and there may be a reflash that comes out. So that's something, you know, if you took it in, there probably isn't one available now, but if your complaint is filed and enough people complain, they decide that characteristic's a little bit, you know, a little bit too rough for most people, they may come out with an enhancement for that, a reflash. The other thing is that, yeah, it's true that there's not most of these transmissions don't have a dipstick where you can check it yourself, but there is a method that they can check it with. And a couple times I've seen that level off, and they're really sensitive. They are very sensitive to that fluid level being where it should be. You know, it sounds like this doesn't happen most of the time. Happens when it's really hot, but that's really when that fluid level is critical. So if among other things, when they looked at it, if they didn't check the fluid level, that's something you may want to have them do. And it's fairly complicated. You may need to leave the vehicle overnight because you have to check it when it's partly warmed up, not hot. So it's not as straightforward as it used to be to pull that dipstick out and look, but that's certainly something worth checking out or having checked out.
All right, good luck. Thanks a lot, Aaron, for calling. Appreciate your call. Jim Ward, our guest today, service director at Smart Motors of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer, here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your vehicle today with our guest, Jim Ward, service director at Smart Motors. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us. The line, well, there may be a line open for you at 800-642-1234. Email us your question at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to the phones and turn to Jay in Two Rivers, Wisconsin. Hi, Jay.
Oh, good morning. Thank you.
Sure.
Just picked up a used 2013 Jetta sport wagon, and I need new tires, and it's only got 40,000 miles on it, but yet it's had a tire change and apparently a coolant change. According to the owner's manual, the coolant, if it was original, should have been pink. Well, now it's orange. It looks clean, but it's not original. And the tires are 205 R55, and they need to be changed. I'm wondering, should I stick with that size, or is there any advantage of going up to, say, a 215? And should I just have the coolant completely flushed and changed? And does it need to be the VW specific pink?
Well, let's talk about the coolant first. It doesn't necessarily have to be the manufacturer's brand of coolant, as long as it's the right type of coolant, and it likely is. The coolant, antifreeze, comes from the manufacturers who make it colorless. They're clear. And so, you know, for example, at our shop, we have different coolants for different budgets. So the economy coolant actually is delivered to us in a bulk truck, and it doesn't have a color, and we put a powder dye in it so that it looks like what you expect to see. And that's true everywhere. So color is meaningless. I could make your coolant green, purple, or orange, or whatever color, you know, we wanted to put in there, but the type of coolant is what's important. And that coolant on a 13 Jetta, well, at 40,000 miles, I'm surprised it was changed already. That would be a little quicker than the manufacturer and Volkswagen recommends. But, you know, a lot of shops, it just used to be every 2 years, you know, let's get that stuff out of there. It helps prevent corrosion. So, it's not necessarily a bad thing. But, you know, I would have it tested. The biggest concern is that it's the right ratio, that it's mixed to 35 below. One of the biggest differences in coolant throughout the world is that in North America, we have really hard water. It has a lot of minerals and things in it, which is why manufacturers, even cars that come from other parts of the world, go with super long life antifreeze, which really just means they've already mixed the purified water in it so that they don't take the chance that you're putting those minerals that are in our tap water, because you can buy pure antifreeze here and they tell you to mix it 50-50, but our water is not a good mix for that antifreeze. So not knowing what's in it is probably the biggest concern if I was going to have it changed, simply because we don't know if they put regular water in there, which isn't going to cause anything to immediately blow up, but over the long term, it's not the best for preventing corrosion and other issues in the cooling system. When it comes to your tires, the tires that you want to go with, that you really are best to go with, are, again, that placard we talked about earlier that is on the driver's door, on the end of the driver's door, the door jamb, will tell the tire pressure, but it also tells the tire size that should be on that vehicle. And someone might have changed them. Sometimes the numbers on a tire, so for example, you mentioned yours are 205-55. You didn't mention there's also a third number. That third number is how many inches in diameter your rim is. And you can only, that third number you can't play with to put the same tire on the same wheel. If they're 15-inch wheels, you have to put a 15-inch tire on it. You can't put a 16 or a 14. But the first two numbers, really, 205 tells you how many millimeters wide that tire is. In the winter, the narrower tire, obviously, the better it's going to cut through the snow, but you need to have handling for all conditions, not just going through snow. The second number is a ratio of the first number. So if 205 is the first number, that means the tire is 205 millimeters wide. And the second number means that the height, the sidewall height, is 55% of that 205. But again, so there's a little lesson in what the numbers on your tire mean. But most important, I would go by that placard on the door and make sure that you got the right size on there.
There you go. Thank you so much, Jay, for calling. Appreciate it. And let's go to John in Pound, Wisconsin. Hi, John.
Well, how are you doing today?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm just curious. You know, we're staying on tires right now. What is the thing with this nitrogen gas you inflate your tires with? It is just it's supposed to keep your tires cooler, I think. But what good does it do me up here up north? Is it just a fake or fallacy?
Well, I would, you know, the way that the nitrogen for tires is marketed often strikes me as vaporware, you know, one of those things that you just, but there is some truth. There is some truth to it. And you know, they'll say that it, you know, there's less moisture in the tire, this and that. Here's the truth. Nitrogen molecules are larger than just what's in our typical air. Even though just typical air we breathe is mostly nitrogen, the difference is the difference between when the weather gets cold, whether you're going to see that tire light come on or actually have your tire pressures drop quite a bit. So we get overnight temperatures this time of year that drop 10, 15, 20, 25 degrees sometimes. Most shops are going to see a parade. We see a parade of people coming the next morning with their tire lights on because of that difference. People who put nitrogen in the tires don't tend to have that because that nitrogen adds just enough advantage that there is always going to be almost a porosity between the rim and the tire itself, and some air will be lost over time. You know, some tires and some wheels and some cars more than others, but that is the primary thing that nitrogen changes, that you get less of that air loss. It changes if you start really talking about high speeds, high performance, high heat. They use nitrogen a lot in racing. They use nitrogen a lot in the aircraft industry. Hopefully you're not dealing with those kind of heat and those conditions, and most of us are not. But it is true that the people that have the nitrogen tire are not the people that are in the parade creeping to get air in the morning after those cold overnight temperature drops.
There you go, John. Thank you so much for calling. Good information there. Nick in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Unfortunately, I got to put my motorcycle away, which just kills me.
Oh, it's way too early.
Yeah, that's what I said. But my wife says yes. But I've asked five different people. I got five different answers. Last year when I started, I put that stable in it. Mm-hmm. And when I took it out of storage, it was backfiring. It was just horrible. So I don't want to do that again. But what would you suggest?
You know, stable is a good product and it does work. And unfortunately, it doesn't work for me because that bottle that's on my shelf that never gets into the machines that have to sit for the winter just doesn't work that way. I would drain the gas out. I would drain it out on machines that are not going to be used for a few months or over the winter months like that. It just, you know, the stable, first of all, if you're pouring it in the tank, it's in the tank. If you just pour it in the tank, it's not going to protect the entire fuel system. You got to pour it in the tank, and then you got to run the engine so that you get it into the carburetor and injectors, the places where deposits are going to start to form, where the fuel is going to start to break down, and you get gel and goo and stuff after a few months that are there. So it is a product that works, but simply putting it in the tank isn't enough. But I still find that I don't know if it's just my own laziness. I buy the stable. It sits on the shelf. I don't get around to it. I drain the fuel. That way I just know I've done the right thing and it's all out and I'm not going to have that.
And you drain the fuel. You don't run it out of gas.
Well, you can running it out of gas actually is the preferred way to do it. But
depending
on the machine. Because, again, where the fuel is, and either at right up to the injectors or right up to the needle valves and stuff in the carburetor is where you want to get it out of. It really isn't like it causes a huge problem in the tank itself. But
Somebody told me one time, well, that's hard on the engine if you run it out of gas.
Well, and there are vehicles, and that's why I hesitate to say that, because if you've got like a hybrid car and you're going to store it for 6 months, you don't want to do that. That really is going to lead to some complications when you try to start that back up again. But you want to get it completely out of the fuel system, not just the tank.
All right. There you go, Nick. Thank you for calling. And let's turn to Bob in Menominee. Hi, Bob.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
I have a 2012 Dodge Journey, all-wheel drive. And as I'm sitting at a stop sign or stoplight and I need to make either a left or right-hand turn and I take off, it feels and sounds like it's losing traction in one of the tires, like it's spinning faster than the others. But when I go straight off the stop, I don't have that. Is this something that I need to be concerned about?
Well, you know, it's... You're not getting any warning lights, and are you? Well, let's say that a tire is spinning and changing is at a different speed than the others. One of the things that helps prevent that are the speed sensors that both the anti-lock brake system and a traction control system use with your all-wheel drive. You're going to have a traction control system on that. And if a speed sensor has certain types of malfunctions, it'll set a code and turn on a light. The problem is that often the computer doesn't know that tire isn't either accelerating faster or decelerating faster than the other tires. It assumes, oh, this is really happening. So it doesn't see it as a fault and it doesn't set a fault code. The only way that you can really see that happening is to have some kind of a scan tool hooked up to it so that you can look at live data of those sensors and find out if it's really happening. It'll show it to you. But again, the computer that monitors that system won't see it as a fault because for all it knows, it's really happening, and when in fact it may just be a sensor that's giving a misreading and telling it that one wheel is skidding or spinning and has lost traction. So that's how we get to the bottom of that. If we're wondering if that's what's going on, we look at the data live while the car is being driven. This is a two-person job, and find out.
And then what happens if it is? Is there anything you do
about
it?
Well, you see which one it is and replace that sensor. It'll tell you.
You can see
left front, right front, left rear, right rear, and you basically, if one of them's falling out and that's not what's really happening on the car, then that sensor's malfunctioning. Mm-hmm. It's telling the computer something. The computer's reacting, but that's not, in fact, what's really going on the road.
There we go. Bob, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Philip in Kingston, your turn. Hi, Philip.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I have a 94 Ford Tempo GL. And the problem is that when I let off the gas, you know, when you're reaching a stop sign or a light, the car just keeps on moving and doesn't slow down. I notice when this happens, if it doesn't slow down, I'll slip it into neutral while I'm driving, and the car just races without even stepping on the gas, like if I slammed on the gas. And this happens on and off. It's not constant. But on and off, sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. So I guess the problem is, you know, it wears out my brakes and terrible gas mileage because the car doesn't want to slow down. Any ideas?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's just the basic idea that the car will move at idle without your foot on the brake. It isn't as though it's in neutral. So if it's in gear with an automatic transmission, you're at idle, it will move. If the engine's cold, the engine's supposed to have a faster idle speed. The colder out it is, the higher that idle speed will be. And so there is some normal function kind of close to what you're describing. However, there are abnormal things that can make that idle speed or that engine speed too high under those conditions. One thing that will make it higher that's not abnormal is that if you have your air conditioner on, and even if you don't have it switched on, if you have your car on defrost, on any of the defrost settings, in other words, you have the air directed to go to the windshield or the windshield and the feet, the air conditioner is running, the compressor is on, and that will send a signal to the engine's computer to tell it to raise the idle speed. So with a cold engine or with the air conditioner on, the car in gear from a stop, taking your foot off the brake, will accelerate to a higher speed and go faster than it would otherwise. But there are also devices that are supposed to help control the air that goes into the fuel system, things like an idle air control valve that can get varnished up and sticky over time, and that can cause intermittent conditions like you're describing. So the air conditioner is the easiest one to play with. The fan turns off the air conditioning no matter how you had it set. If you turn the blower fan on the inside of the car off, the air conditioner is off. So if you're experiencing this and you turn the fan for the ventilation system off and the condition stops, it's related to the air conditioner. If that doesn't change it, then it comes down to someone starting to check and see if something like an idle air control valve or some other fuel system air control is sticking, and or if throttle plate is gummed up and causing it to stick, and that would make it create a faster engine speed than you should have and create the kind of symptoms you're describing as well.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Tim emailed to say he has a 2015 Mercedes C350, and it requires premium fuel. How bad would it be to use regular fuel?
Well, it's probably going to ping, cause pre-ignition. That can, over a long term, cause engine damage. You should use the fuel that the manufacturer of that vehicle recommends you use. It should be premium fuel if that's what's designated.
Annie emailed to say that the fan inside her car, the one that's for heat and air, works but doesn't blow. What could be the problem and how much would it cost?
That's an interesting question.
Is there a hose or something that's broken?
Well, there are ducts, and that's one of the things that I think of. Earlier we were talking about that cabin filter, and if the local mouse family has decided to build a condominium on top of that cabin filter, we're not going to get airflow through it. So try as that fan may, if it can't pull air in from the outside, it can't blow air into the inside. But someone needs to take a look in there. Typically, blower motor problems are that they quit working and you have to replace the blower motor, and you're usually looking at a couple hundred, $200 to $300 to do that. But if you can hear that motor, the blower, when you turn it on and off, but you're not getting air, either there's something blocking it or there's something, vehicles have switching valves that direct where the air is supposed to go. Those things can get stuck just from some, you know, something breaking in the linkage or getting out of sync with each other, or again, you know, mice can get in and other places in the ventilation system other than just by that cabin filter. If they chew their way through the cabin filter and start making wings on that, you know, condominium, then they may be getting to places where a door is supposed to be able to open or close that can't anymore because there's something in the way. But someone's going to have to start looking at some of the ducts and some of the control valves, and that cabin filter is where I would start to find out if air can get in, and if it's getting in, why can't it get to the vent louvers and...
Makes sense. And Todd in Delavan emailed to say he has a 2010 Jeep Wrangler Unlimited. Recently, when it rains hard, it'll run rough when starting. After a few minutes, it runs fine. And then the second part also, the floor mat on the driver's side gets soaking wet in a hard rain. He heard that it could be a window seal that gets the floor wet and a crack in the distributor cap. You know, any thoughts on that?
You try to resist saying these things, but you know, don't drive in the rain. No, that's not the answer. That's not the answer. With the ignition, an ignition system can cause an engine to run rough in wet and rainy conditions. You know, whether you have a distributor or whether you have electronic ignition that has a coil right over the spark plug, those can start to break down. The insulation starts to break down. One of the easiest ways to try to duplicate that when it's not raining and you're trying to duplicate it is soapy water. You take some soapy water in a spritzer, like some Dawn dish soap, and spray it on them, and that tends to really, a coil or a distributor that has a little bit of an insulation, poor insulation issue is really going to be affected by that and likely to really react and when it's under that condition. So you may have separate coil packs on each plug. If you did, you'd spray that on each one at a time and see which one reacts, or a distributor on an older type of ignition system would behave the same way. So that's where you start trying to diagnose that kind of a problem. Most likely, if it's affected by moisture and humidity, it's an ignition type problem. With the water getting into the vehicle, there are different ways that water can get in. You may have a compromised door or window seal, and that often can be diagnosed simply by water testing. You know, someone sits on the inside and somebody's on the outside with a hose and sprays it. But a couple of other common sources are that sunroofs don't really seal water out 100%. They have a trough around the outside of a sunroof in a vehicle. So if you have a sunroof, that trough catches the water, and then there are tubes that go out the back pillars and the windshield pillars in front and to drain that water out on the ground. Again, if you live in an area with certain types of trees that have really fine, leaf seedlings and different things can get in there, those drain tubes can get plugged up, and then that water is going to end up, you know, depending on where it is, it can either come in over the top of the sunroof or it can end up on your floor. Similarly, the air conditioning systems have water that condenses in them and collects in a little pan down in the base of your dash, and that's got a drain hose out underneath the car. And if that gets plugged up, that's also going to be a source of water that can get into your floorboard. So it's a process of elimination. You know, you can test the door and window seals. You can test the sunroof seals too. Basically, with the sunroof open, you take a cup of water, pour it into that trough, and watch that it comes out underneath the car. It's a little tougher to do a test yourself with the air conditioning and heater drain, although, you know, on a humid enough day, if you run the air conditioner, you should see water draining out underneath the car. That drains usually in the firewall, a little bit off-center to the passenger side is where that would drift from.
Let's take another call on to Joe in Wausau next. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I have a 2008 Toyota Tundra.
Okay.
And ever since I bought it, when I make a sharp turn, either forward or in reverse, it jerks. Instead of making a smooth turn, it's a jerky turn.
Mm-hmm.
Is that normal? Or
It is pretty normal, depending on circumstances. You're going to have that truck in two-wheel drive. If you are on a surface where it can slip, if you're on snow, ice, mud, something where a wheel can spin, then you'd put it in four high. And four high... basically is not appropriate for dry pavement and not even lightly wet pavement. It's got to be really slippery to be in four high. If you get stuck and you can no longer move at all, that's the time that you'd put it in four low. So if you're trying to drive in four low in any kind of conditions, that's not appropriate. You know, if you're trying to drive in four high, it needs to be gravel, mud, snow, really wet. Consider this. Normally, as you go around a corner, that outside tire has got to turn at a faster speed than the inside tire. When you put it in four-wheel drive, that's no longer possible. They're going to turn at the same speed. And if they can't slip on some surface and spin, you're going to get just what you're describing.
Yeah. There we go. Thanks a lot, Joe, for calling. And on to Ann in East Troy. Hello, Ann.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate your call. What can we do for you?
I have a 2009 Toyota Camry Hybrid. I've got 134,000 miles on it. I'm very happy with it. Runs like a champ. But I have a friend in car sales and a couple family members telling me I'd better do something about trading it in, sort of as a preventative measure, given that it is a hybrid. People are nervous about the battery going on me. And I just wondered what your guests think.
Well, of course, your car has two batteries. It has a 12-volt battery, just like every other car does, and its replacement should be really when the testing that's done every 6 months starts telling you predictively that that battery's not long for this world. But I think your friends and what you're talking about are the high-voltage battery, the hybrid battery that's in the car. You know, by and large, we see those batteries last a long, long time, like you would expect an engine or transmission. It's a big part of the powertrain. Typically, 200,000-300,000 miles is not at all uncommon for those things. And they're getting more and more reasonable in cost to replace. It is an expensive item. It is comparable to having to do a big engine repair or transmission repair when you have to replace that battery. But, you know, I would really not look at it different than a transmission or an engine kind of repair. If you get 200,000 to 300,000 miles out of the car, it really probably doesn't owe you much. And if it's in really good shape and everything else is in good shape, you know, most people would find it worthwhile to put a transmission or an engine in a car of that age if they thought they were going to keep it. You know, again, some people trade their cars every 2-3 handful of years, and some people try to keep them 10 years. And if you're part of that latter group, you know, I've seen many, many people replace those batteries and get, you know, another, you know, several years of good life out of them. So it, you know, it really on a vehicle that new, I don't think it's a big concern at this point. It's kind of early to be worrying about that.
Anna, a question for you. How many miles do you have on that vehicle right now?
134.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would really expect you to be able to double that. I mean, again, you know, failure of any component's got a bell-shaped curve. Some fail early, some last unusually longer than we expect, but most of those are going to get you well into the 200,000 to 300,000 mile range.
There you go, Ann. Thank you so much for calling. And Steve in Minnow Point, your turn. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is on brake fluid changing. How often should you do that, if at all?
You know, different manufacturers have different recommendations. Some manufacturers will say every 2 years or 30,000 miles. Some manufacturers won't have an interval, but the brake fluid is one of the fluids, again, that's checked. You know, the vehicle should have an inspection every 6 months. And brake fluid is a hydroscopic oil. It's a hydraulic oil, and it's hydroscopic, which means that it absorbs moisture. You don't want moisture to be able to collect into a water bubble somewhere into a brake system and cause interference, prevent the pressure from being able to go where it's supposed to go. So hydroscopic fluids break that moisture up. And as a result, they start to change color, and brake fluid starts out looking like honey or beer, perhaps, and over time it gets darker and darker. There are also sediment tests that can be done with brake fluid, but you know, you put some on a little specialized kind of paper that will make the sediment spread to the outside and take a look and see if there's a certain amount of sediment in it. You know, I don't know that I'm a big fan of those chemical tests. You know, unless the brake fluid really, really starts to look rough, you know, if the manufacturer has a recommendation, I would probably follow that recommendation, but most manufacturers don't, and it's basically done on a visual, you know, appearance.
Inspection, yeah.
Based, yep.
There you go, Steve. Thank you so much for calling. Visiting today with Jim Ward, Service Director at Smart Motors. Always great to have him come by, and thank you so much for listening. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Well, Jim Ward, perfect. What do you think's wrong with that vehicle?
I love it. You know, it's we can't even narrow that one down.
Dave Botrans found that for us. Dave, what do we have there?
That's a famous bit, might have heard before, called the Maxwell car, referred to as the Maxwell car. It was performed by Mel Blanc way, way back when. Originally, it was part of a skit for the Jack Benny radio show. Back in the 1920s, the Maxwell car. Mel Blanc, of course, known as the Man of a Thousand Voices. And you probably heard him. He's most famous for cartoon characters like Bugs Bunny, Porky Pig, Daffy Duck, Elmer Fudd, and many, many, many more. And the Maxwell, of course, was a brand of automobiles manufactured in the U.S. from about 1904 to 1925. And interesting, the present-day successor of the Maxwell Company is Fiat Chrysler Automobiles. Well, that's what I found out, thanks to Wikipedia.
Great. Thanks, Dave Protras. That's kind of fun to hear.
It sounded like a Fiat pop for sure. <aren't you? laughs>
Well, let's take some more questions here. You can join in 800-642-1234. That was fun. Alan in Sun Prairie will give you a chance. Hi, Alan.
Hello.
What's on your mind today?
Well, I've got a 2006 Dodge Dakota, and I've got about a 25-minute drive to and from work. About halfway to work and halfway home, my transmission temperature light comes on. I've put a new solenoid pack in there. I've got new fluid, new gaskets and filter, and I wound up taking it to Kaiser in Watertown because at one point I found out that they had replaced a computer in there. They told me that, yes, the computer probably is the problem, but they won't replace it until they figure out what electrical problem is probably causing this. And so I asked them if I could just replace the wiring harness. They said they can't get one anymore. Am I just in trouble, or do I have some options?
This is a tough one. So kind of a known computer problem there with those, but, you know, one of the things that I'd want to see, first of all, because it kind of sounds like the question is the transmission fluid getting hot, or is it simply giving a false signal that the transmission fluid is hot? And ultimately, that's, again, where the right scan device, that's not even going to be easy. But that's one of the things you want to determine is how hot the fluid is really getting. If you're getting a false signal, you've got a sensor or something that, or a communication problem between that sensor and the computer, you may be getting warnings that are not really what's going on in the transmission. The fluid may not be getting hot. I mean, it sounds like they've, you know, basically, if it weren't for all that background with the computer and wiring concerns, I would be talking about checking the transmission cooler and making sure that it's not getting plugged up and that the fluid's getting through it properly. But, you know, if we've got an electronic problem, in particular something where a wire harness isn't available, or wire harnesses can be repaired. I mean, you can track down, you know, most technicians are kind of loath to do it because, you know, if this repair doesn't work, it's all kind of on me. Yeah. As opposed to if I put a new harness on, then it's on the manufacturer. But it really is, you know, like a neurosurgeon dealing with nerves to somewhat lesser degree to start doing some of that testing and narrow down just what's going on with that circuitry. But, you know,
at least test the sensor.
Typically a cheap job, but the sensor can be tested. The sensor is probably cheaper to replace and try. But again, the question is the transmission really even getting hot? Or are we just getting bad readings? If it's not getting hot, it's not something I hesitate to tell you to ignore it, because then one day when it does get hot, you overheat and ruin your transmission. So this is just a tough one. Those are not easy or inexpensive things to get to the bottom of. You know, someone that is intimately familiar with that wiring and that transmission could go through and do pen testing, but it is just hours and hours of work.
Yeah, and that's expensive for sure.
Yep.
There you go, Alan. I wish we had better news for you, but there you have it. Angie in Appleton will give you a chance. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. Or is it still morning? Yeah, it is still morning. Good morning. I have a 25-year-old 1994 Mercury Cougar, which is my daily driver. I wish I could tell you the mileage I've on it, but 3 years ago the odometer stopped at 137,000 miles, which is why it probably still runs. It doesn't know any better. So I'm wondering, if the air conditioner doesn't work, if I have that fixed, is that going to be a huge draw on the engine, or would that be too much for the engine to fix the air conditioner in a car that's old?
A 25-year-old car's engine, one 25-year-old car's engine's condition compared to another's is not something we can really determine over a phone call. The air conditioner does put a load on the engine. when it's running. And you know, some of the greater concerns I might have about that is availability of parts. That air conditioner is likely an old form of Freon, and which is not really readily available. They do make kits to change those and modify them to newer forms of Freon, but that can be expensive to do, you know, once you even figure out what's wrong with it. So you know, finding out whether it's a compressor or electronic control sensor or something, getting it diagnosed is one thing, but actually getting it fixed on a 25-year-old car is really it's going to be a much greater challenge, because it's going to have to be converted over to probably R134A from the R12 that it was likely built with. So that, you know, that is an uphill. That's an uphill battle on that car, and it's probably going to be expensive. We're getting some calls here on things that just aren't probably viable or recommended to do just because of the age of it. It could be done, but you know.
You might want to think about other.
It's not real promising. I'm not as worried about whether the engine can handle a working air conditioner as what it's going to take to get that air conditioning on a car that age working.
Yeah, there you go, Angie. Something to think about. Let's go to Jason in Menominee, Michigan next. Hi, Jason.
Hi. I got a couple questions, and then I'll listen off the air for your answers. I'm having trouble finding a place to recycle antifreeze, and I'm wondering if it actually goes bad. And also, my brakes are making a funny squeal. I thought they needed to be replaced. The mechanic said they may have developed like a layer or a patina that just needs to be ground off. Is that a thing? Thanks. And cool Mel Blanc clip earlier.
All right, thanks a lot, Jason.
So antifreeze, typically shops that replace antifreeze usually will take used antifreeze. We do, you know, because they have to recycle it themselves, and you want to offer a service to customers to encourage them to come and see you. So I would just check with the shop that you normally go to, or if you don't find a shop locally, and see what they would help you with that. Antifreeze, in terms of expiration, manufacturers have different intervals that they'll, you know, you want to go by your manufacturer's interval for it. Brake noise, most of the brake noise that we investigate, or at least half of it, does not turn out to be worn brake pads. Brakes tend to have warning clips that will make a high-pitched noise to warn you when they start getting down near the wear limit. But as often as not, it is some kind of oxidation forming that will contribute to brake noise. The level of humidity that we have, and the salt and stuff that's used on the roads in Wisconsin, really contribute to what happened to brakes in Wisconsin. They don't see this much in Arizona and Southern California, but the device that applies and releases your brakes, called a brake caliper, has pins that everything that the pad should be able to slide freely to apply the brake and slide freely to release that brake. And a lot of times those will start to get rusted up from our salt and the climate that we have. And if they're not applying properly, it'll allow more oxidation. The only thing that keeps rust from building up on that brake disc or rotor that your pads apply against is the friction from them. So, you know, sometimes we see where the pad is only applying to part of that rotor, that you know, only the toward the center of it, and the outside half might not be getting an application, or the other way around. So, you know, that can be mild or severe, but it can contribute to brake noise. The other thing is that you know, there's nothing wrong with being a light breaker, braking early and you know, anticipating a stop, as opposed to the guy that hauls it all to a stop in those last 10 feet. But that latter person that brakes harder and creates a lot more friction tends to have less of that oxidation buildup. So if nothing's hanging up in the brake system, a mechanic's looked at it, he probably would have told you if you didn't look like you were getting even padded application and there was a caliper pin problem. So this may just be flash oxidation. And one of the easiest ways to test that is, you know, that kind of oxidation can form as quickly as overnight. You could take the car on the highway. You want to be a little careful about who's behind you and what's around you, and you don't want to lock up your tires, but a couple of hard brakes create some friction. If after that the noise is immediately gone, that's what it is. It's just flax oxidation that's forming on them.
There we go. On to George in Partyville. Hi, George. George, are you there? Oh, maybe we lost George. Let's try Jerry in West Allis. Jerry, hello.
Hi. George and Partyville. Yep, turn my radio off. Love the show.
Thank you.
I have a 1988 Mustang 5.0, and the as soon as you go to start-wise, when you start it, wants to die. You have to flutter the gas pedal in order to keep it running, and I'm looking to try to fix that.
Yeah.
So after you keep it running and it gets warmed up, then it will idle?
Yeah, and then it will idle, but it still has that high-low run to it. It still has a high-low run to it.
Sure, sure.
It'll stop sign, and it'll be fine, and all of a sudden it'll pick up, and it'll come down, and
throttle,
you know, a half dozen times before the light changes.
Sure. Throttle plates and again, air control valves can get sticky and varnished, and they can cause that kind of a symptom. The engine needs the right mixture. It's more susceptible to that kind of a problem when it's cold. When it's cold, it's just critical that it has the right mixture. Once it's warmed up, that may not be affecting it as much, or you know, the valve might be in the right position for a warm engine and not a cold engine. But that's some testing that needs to be done there. There's probably something varnished up or stuck that is not allowing you to get the right mixture when it's cold.
There you go. Thank you so much. Russ in Sun Prairie emailed to say he has a Pathfinder to salvage. What's the best place to take it for the most money? I could even mention that, you know, we have a vehicle donation program at Wisconsin Public Radio, and you can go online to WPR, click the support button, and you can get some information on it there. Or you can call 866-789-8627. That's 866-789-8627.
And that kind of charitable contribution is tax deductible. So that's, you know, something you want to think about. But in terms of getting the most money out of it, that's probably not where you're going to get the most money, nor calling a salvage yard. If you have the luxury of having a place to store that car and you have the ability to take that car apart, selling the parts and selling the pieces off is the way to make the most money off of it. But that's not most people. Most people don't have that storage space or have that ability to take a piece off at a time and send the starter here and, you know, this, there, and that to another place. So getting the most money out of it really depends on you having a certain specific set of skills and a place to keep that vehicle while you do that.
So there you go, Russ. You might think about WPR. Click that support button or call 866-789-8627. Jim Ward, our guest today from Smart Motors of Madison. He'll be with us till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news and then be back. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your automobile today with vehicle maintenance expert Jim Ward. He's the service director at Smart Motors of Madison. Lots of experience dealing with all kinds of cars, and it's always fun to have him come on. If you have a question for him, you can email us at ideas@wpr.org or phone in at 800-642-1234. Lots of callers online, so let's go to Mike in Menominee Falls next. Mike, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Here's my problem. I have a 98 Silverado half-ton pickup, four-wheel drive, in excellent condition, all that kind of stuff, 125,000 miles. When I step on the gas, I can feel the gas pedal, a little vibration, slowly, and as I'm driving, I can feel it a little bit. Front end's been checked, tires checked, balance is checked, front end done, all these things. And I still feel that little bit of vibration. And when I hook my boat on and I get on the highway, 60, 65 miles an hour, or just right in that range, I get a little higher, the front end will start shaking. I back off, then it's fine. I can drive 60 or a little less, and no problem. But when I step on the gas and have that torque, I had one universal replaced last year, but I can just feel this in the gas pedal. At first I thought, maybe, am I really feeling this? But then when I,
so it's
when I have
pretty
the
subtle.
On.
Pretty subtle, it sounds like. Well, you're, a couple things you've said that I just want to clarify. When we talk about a front-end vibration, we're talking about a vibration you feel in the steering wheel. I mean, that's front tires, you know, front drive axle, anything in the front is going to give you a vibration in the steering wheel. If you're feeling it in the floorboard, the gas pedal, or somewhere else, then it's less likely to be that front, you know, powertrain clip and steering and suspension and tires, and probably something either throughout somewhere else throughout the drivetrain. A U-joint was one of the things that comes to mind that can cause that kind of thing, and it sounds like it's a fairly subtle vibration that you're feeling. you know, that is one of the more difficult things to find. If you have a noise or a rattle that you hear, you can use what are called chassis ears and put them on different components, and there's multiple ones you can put on, and you got a little box that you can go from circuit to circuit and try to narrow it down. But when it's just a subtle vibration like that, especially throughout a vehicle, it's that becomes very, very difficult to narrow down. I wish I could give you some great advice on what you might do. I suspect you probably have had it checked out. The thing that really all I can recommend is that you monitor it. If it starts to change, I would have it looked at again. If it seems like it's getting more severe or does it under different circumstances. But, you've had a U-joint done. That is, for that kind of a vibration, that's one of the prime suspects. But, I've had all the tires balanced and all that checked. Yeah, this is just simply not one I can tell you, a quick and easy lead for it. But monitor it. If it changes, have it checked out some more, and hopefully it becomes more obvious to what's going on there.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Mike. And George in Partyville, your turn. Hi, George.
Hi, Larry. Are you there?
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Hi, Jim. So I got an oil question.
Okay.
So I'm kind of running an old Meyer snowplow on my 19 or 2000 Chevy, and it leaks oil. And my question is, what would be the? Could you add regular transmission fluid to your snowplow instead of buying expensive snowplow oil all the time?
It's not really recommended that you run transmission fluid. Not that it wouldn't work as a hydraulic fluid, but it doesn't have additives, and it particularly doesn't have some of the kind of antifreeze or hydroscopic properties to keep the moisture out of it that are more likely to form in that kind of a system. Meyer snowplow oil is pretty expensive. Name brands usually are. Typically, in a situation like yours where you got a leaker, it's either get the leak fixed so that you don't have that going on, but that can be expensive, or consider something like an alternative like Napa Blue Magic as a pretty reasonable fluid. I have seen guys literally find where the leak is and wire little catch cans so that they can catch their fluid and put it back in those kind of circumstances. But that's not necessarily always easy to do. But if you're not going to fix the leak, then a cheaper fluid rather than the name brand Meyer is probably what you want to look at.
There you go. And on to Mike in Manitowoc. Hi.
Hi, I had a question about a brake controller. I've got a 2014 Ram 2500, and we pull about a 7,000-pound travel trailer, and it's got an integrated brake controller in it, but I'm wondering, does that operate the trailer brakes based off the truck's braking force, or is it pedal travel in the brake? Because I feel like my pedal in the truck is kind of tightly sprung, and I'm not getting a lot of braking power to the trailer, even if I turn the controller up. And I noticed it because I'm getting a lot of brake dust in the front. I don't have any issues stopping, but right. I'm seeing a lot of brake dust in the front.
Well, pulling that kind of weight, just by the nature of things, braking is, the physical forces make the front brakes do more of the work. And a proportioning valve, the trailer notwithstanding, a proportioning valve is supposed to help even that out. But a brake controller can make a huge difference on how a brake controller functions. I pull a travel trailer myself, and I recently upgraded my brake controller. I had a wiring problem, and I thought it was a controller, and I had an old controller that I suspected was it. My test kind of confirmed it, but I had an open that kind of made the test result wrong. I bought a different controller, a more modern one, and I was amazed at the difference. Again, not that the other one wasn't working, but there's an adjustability to brake controllers for sensitivity, and sometimes the integrated ones don't give you that ability. So that's what I would recommend is considering upgrading that brake controller. I think you notice a big difference, or progressive brake controllers with adjustments that you can kind of fine tune that in. It's obviously from what you're describing, it works, but you're looking for something that you can control a little bit better and not push all that braking to the front.
There you go. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. And John in Edgerton, your turn. Hi, John.
Yes, I have a question on a 2007 Lexus RX 350. Just a longevity question. I've got about 298,000 on it. Again, mostly the highway type miles. What's the longevity of an alternator and a starter? So this is being run on the road a lot. Have you noticed any patterns of any problems with these two items on Lexus or Toyota?
Well, those miles, I'm going to tell you about 300,000 miles now. You're getting close. You know, those devices may outlast everything else on the car, but they are something that we see fail from time to time. And there's not a predictive test for your alternator. Like a battery's got some predictive tests that many components on a vehicle do, but an alternator or starter, either one on a 295,000 mile car, are either one things that could go now or could last another 100,000 miles. You know, if they fail, you know, ultimately, that is one area, you know, if the car is in reasonably good shape otherwise, that, you know, there's a lot of things on a car you could do with aftermarket parts. Starters and alternators are not two areas I've seen good luck with most, not just Toyotas and Lexus, but an awful lot of Japanese or Asian type imports have the aftermarket starters and alternators that are available. We tend to see short life out of 6 months to a year, whereas the original remanufactured units tend to last a lot longer, more like the life that you got out of this one. But yeah, unfortunately, I can't predict. I mean, those are not components that I would really recommend replacing preemptively, because that's not necessarily at all, and no one could predict that that's what's going to go next on the vehicle.
There you go. Thank you so much. You know, Barbara emailed to say she just moved to central Wisconsin and she can't help but notice all the rust on cars there. She has a 2015 Honda CR-V. Should she take measures to prevent rust? Underspray, frequent washing in the winter? Is that possible here?
That is all a good idea. I'm not sure where Barbara moved from, but if you move from outside the Midwest, there's about 27 states that use salt in this part of the country, and in that salt belt, the vehicles are far different. When we go to different parts of the country, like to Southern California and Arizona, we're amazed to see those 71 Ford pickups that have this beautiful patina. The sun's baked the paint practically off of them, but they're not rusted. The bottom foot is still there. You can still take tie rod, you know, mounting that stuff apart. But in Wisconsin, that stuff starts to rust out. So your friend here is to keep that vehicle clean and to get a protective coating on it. You want to have that vehicle waxed. When you go, and if it's something you're inclined to do yourself, if you go and look, I can never say this word right, but the Parbuna wax that is a typical wax, you know, tree-based wax, will give the best appearance, but it doesn't bond to the paint as well. The synthetic waxes that are actually easier to put on tend to bind to the paint, stay on better, give better long-term protection for Wisconsin winters. But cleaning the vehicle regularly, getting a good protection on it in the fall is really what you want to do to stay ahead of that.
And if there's a car wash of some type or another, you say, I want to go with the wax, is that wax that you get in a car wash? Do you know offhand if that's
not going to be anywhere near as good as something that is, you know, put on by a detail shop. That's either put on by hand or put on with a buffer. It's just simply, you just can't coat a car. I mean, it's better than nothing, but it really doesn't compare to you know, hand waxing or a detail shop doing that for you.
All right. On to another caller, Dan in Spring Valley. It's your turn. Hi, Dan.
Well, good morning.
Hi, Dan.
I need to know what to do with a rebuilt engine I installed in my mail delivery Jeep. It's dripping oil, burning oil, and it's got it's like 3,000 miles on the rebuilt. And another problem was the starter died. And in the mornings when I go to start, if I don't hold the key just before start, it's a hard start. But I did have replaced was the coolant engine control. But everything seems to be a problem here. I was wondering what to do.
That you got a lot of different issues going on there, although Jeeps are pretty diehard. If you've got a lot of oil leaks, you know, leaks don't usually amount to much in the way of oil consumption. Oil consumption, if you're really going through oil, if you're going through excess of a quart in 1,000 to 1,200 miles, that's probably not from leaking out, not unless you're getting basketball size puddles every time you stop. It takes a lot of leaking to produce consumption that you're going to see while driving. Consumption that is produced while driving is either going by the valve seals and getting burned with the gas in the cylinder, or it's coming by the piston rings. Valve seals, there's nothing you can do but replace those. Piston rings may get varnished up, and there are things you can try. I hesitate to tell you to do it yourself or to do this stuff, but I've seen, you know, draining the oil, filling the engine back up 1 quart short, putting a quart of automatic transmission fluid in it, running it for about 15 minutes, draining that back out, doing that a couple of different times. If it's varnish buildup on rings, sometimes that procedure can clean them up, and you might reduce oil consumption from that. But, you know, you're kind of limited to those things. Fix the leaks, replace the valve seals. You can try devarnishing piston rings, but, you know, again, I've seen it work, but I wouldn't say that that's going to work in most cases. Ultimately, it would be either tearing that engine down, rebuilding it, replacing it with another one, you're kind of limited what you can do with that. In terms of the starting, I guess I'm not quite perfectly clear. If you turn the key to start it, if you don't hold the key, the starter doesn't engage.
The starter engages, but it's like starving for fuel. It doesn't pop off like it should.
And yet if you hold the key and just keep holding it in that start position, then it does start better.
It takes longer. It's a delayed start.
Yeah. It's got an electronic system to help it start. It's not like it's got a standard choke like an old vehicle would have, and I think they replace an electronic sensor that is a potential component, but basically it needs to be tested while it's cold during that start cycle to find out really what is going on there. It may be that we have an ignition switch that's not sending the right signal or not sending it quick enough. That's something that really is going to have to be pen tested between the ignition switch, the computer that gets signals from the sensors, and the sensors themselves, to kind of narrow down what we're just not getting the signal at the right place at the right time.
There you go. Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it. And Steve in Trempealeau, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Good afternoon. I have a question on about a 2005 Honda Element. We turn the defroster on, the lights will dim and then come back. I was wondering if that's something to do with the compressor or what might be causing that.
Well, by defroster, you mean the windshield defroster, not the rear window defroster.
Correct.
Right, right. So, that's turning the air conditioner on. That's putting a load on the engine. The engine, the alternator and the air conditioner are both driven by the crankshaft. And, this could be that you've got a ground problem with the electrical system, but, you know, it may also be that you may have a weak alternator, or you may have dirty connections on your battery. There's a host of things that can cause that, and it may not be that abnormal. I'm not sure how much they died down, but anytime you put a load on the engine, does it? And this is just a momentary thing. They dim and then come back.
Well, it'll be when you're going down the road, they dim and then come back. I was just wondering if the electromechanical clutch on the compressor was causing that, if that was getting bad, or.
Well, that's usually just it's on or off. That's not a real likely cause of that. I think it's more likely you've got a bad ground somewhere and it's just not able to supply voltage and amperage everywhere it's supposed to go because it's looking for ground.
Oh, there you go. Thank you, Steve. Clay in Waukesha, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Clay.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment for one of your other callers that called in with a 98 Chevy Silverado with the vibration that he feels on the accelerator pedal.
Yeah,
I had the same problem, and I thought it was U-joints. I put new U-joints in, and then I thought maybe my drive shaft was bent. I bought a new drive shaft. I spent a ton of money, and I took it into a transmission garage, a really good transmission garage, and they serviced my transmission, and they told me they drove it afterwards and felt the same vibration. And they said that 97, 98, and early 99 Chevy torque converters, they had problems with them. And they were not locking up properly after they got 100,000 miles on it. They told me it'll probably last. Now it had 120 when I had the problem. I got almost 200 on it now. The vibration is still there, but, you know, it's just one of those things that you can change the converter if you want. Or you just live with it, but it does last. But that's what they said it was. If the converter is not locking up at the proper speed.
Huh.
Interesting. Sure. And yep, I've seen that on various models, and it's true. It's not typically a breakdown emergency issue if that's what it is. Usually they're described as a little bit stronger vibration, but you know, one person's, that's a pretty subjective thing. It sounded pretty subtle in the former case, but yep, that is certainly a possibility.
Thanks for that call, Clay. Appreciate it very much. Parker emailed to say he has a 2010 Kia with 170,000 miles on it. Occasionally, a couple times a month, when he's accelerating, the engine will rev up between gear changes. The car started doing this a few months ago. Transmission does not slip when it's in gear. He's wondering what could this be a symptom of? Should he expect transmission problems in the near future? He drives about 3,000 miles a month.
Yeah, well, it is a function of the transmission, and the first thing to check is the fluid level. The fluid level being low could cause that kind of a problem. If that doesn't do it, then really the next diagnostic step is to drain the fluid, probably pull the pan down and find out the drain plug in a transmission pan is magnetic. So, you know, someone that's trying to do a little diagnostic investigating would be either looking for metal in that fluid or looking for fiber in the fluid. If there's fiber in the fluid, that would suggest that the clutch packs are starting to go, which would give you kind of a slip like that as well. But hopefully it's a fluid level.
Yeah,
cheapest,
hopefully.
Easiest.
Yeah, that's for sure. So what should we be keeping our cars in case of emergency? I've got a few things in my car, but what do you think?
Well, you know, some of the most important things, especially going into winter in Wisconsin, is think of yourself first. You know, you want to have the ability to communicate. So there are some pretty neat charge packs that use a battery that you can both jumpstart your car with and charge your cell phone with. So you might have a cell phone that's getting low on charge, so the ability to be able to continue to communicate when you're out there is a very important thing. Secondly, you want to be able to keep warm. So having some, you know, boots, gloves, things to put on. I mean, you know, most emergency kits will have like one of those solar blankets. I would way rather have a great big snowsuit in the trunk than some glove and some big old boots and then a solar blanket that I'm going to wrap around me and shiver with. So, you know, again, you really want to think of yourself some water and some snacks, although in Wisconsin in the wintertime, water is probably going to freeze, you know, but having it in there, you might have a way of thawing it out even if it does freeze. So those are some of the most important things. Secondly, being able to be seen. Emergency flares or those reflective triangles are something pretty important to have in there. You know, this sounds a little odd for that list of things to keep in the car, but a full tank of fuel is something that is in the car, and that's fairly important too, because the car might be stuck, but at least you could run it, keep yourself warm. Sand and kitty litter, you know, if you get stuck are good. A shovel to be able to shove yourself out, a scraper and a snow brush are pretty important things, and you know, the list could go on. I could make a kit that had all kinds of things, but those are the essentials in my opinion.
Yeah, and have all that in the car and you're going to be a lot better if you run off the road, or if the car quits in the middle of a...
And it happens. We all pass somebody on our commute sometimes on those winter days that's sitting there waiting.
Here's one more. Do we need, and you probably get this question a lot, do you need to warm up your car before you leave?
Most modern cars are not engineered to be warm up. They're engineered to warm up while driving. Now, if we're talking extreme cold, I mean, if it's 40 below, even a car engineered to be warmed up that way, it's not going to hurt to run it a little bit. And another game changer has been ethanol. People who run E85 vehicles, it may start, but it may not be real happy to run at real cold temperatures if you're running E85. So that may be another situation where warming it up a little bit if it's running rough is a good idea. But the vast majority of the time, the rule rather than exception is that you warm it up while you're driving it. Start it and go.
Well, Jim, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program for sure.
Pleasure to be here.
And you're back on December 20th, so just before Christmas.
Yeah.
Here comes Jim Ward again.
You're right ahead of Santa Claus.
All right. Right ahead of Santa Claus comes Jim Ward, service director at Smart Motors. I said he has over 10 years of master's certification. He's worked professionally since 1978. Great to have him along. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, Scott Royce will be back with us to talk about fall gardening. That's tomorrow at 11 and Saturday morning at 6, or, of course, online at any time. Just go to WPR.org and check my program. Jim Ward, our guest, thanks for listening here on the Ideas Network.